to the Richard Nixon Experience.
Has anybody asked you about your reaction to the tape transcripts and Watergate in general? Have you talked about that at all?
I think it's bad. Mr. Nixon is going through this, although I'm not a politician, and I don't believe in it, and I don't vote for nobody. But I wrote something once, I heard something once. It says, when we are right, no one remembers, but when we are wrong, no one forgets. I know Nixon's done a lot of good, helping poor people, getting people jobs. I understand he's got a lot of black people in the administration. I understand that he's gave money to people from foreign countries, and he's helped school systems. And I know he's done a lot of good, but they don't worry about, he slipped on a phone call, or did he say this, or what did he mean by that? Everybody's on the poor man for one or two little things. He's done a lot of good. We all do wrong. So why are you going to get on a person because of they did this or he said this? Ain't nobody perfect. His office don't make him perfect. And he's done much, much. When Judgment Day comes, when God comes to judge all of us, on that day, if your good outweighs your bad, you can make it. You're going to have probably 40% bad, most of us. But we're not going to hell because of the bad. We'll make it because of the good. So here's a man, you got one thing on him, you know, that's supposed to be bad. And in the meantime, while you're trying to condemn him, he's out here doing good things every day, helping people and doing. You understand? So I don't think it's unnecessary. Leave the man alone.
Began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
One year of Watergate is enough.
This is a turning point, whatever we decide.
But I cannot condone what I have heard, I cannot excuse it, and I cannot and will not stand still for it.
Should Richard M. Nixon be found guilty of abusing the powers of his office?
Yes.
In the summer of 1974, in the fever of Watergate, Richard M. Nixon resigned as President of the United States. He was the first ever to do that. The President resigned after a committee of the House of Representatives, meeting in this room across the street from the Capitol, recommended that the President be impeached and removed from office. The evidence and the committee's judgment were so persuasive that his friends could tell him what would follow. If the impeachment process ran its course through the House and a trial in the Senate, the President faced sure and overwhelming conviction. I'm Charles McDowell. This is the story of the impeachment inquiry by the House Judiciary Committee. It's also the story of obscure members of Congress, partisan politicians, suspected second-raters, whose remarkable debate here caught the spirit of the Constitution at a crucial time. The committee charged the president with a broad pattern of misconduct in three categories: obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and defiance of Congress. Watergate had come to this, just 2 years after the arrest of some burglars in the Democratic headquarters in Washington.
Welcome to Bridging the Political Gap, Season 7, 1974, Through the Fire, Watergate and Beyond. This is a remarkable story of a great president who will be brought low. What you just heard is from the PBS documentary, The Summer of Judgment, on the House Judiciary Committee. It was an introduction to what all had happened and was getting ready to happen, put together in 1983. It's an excellent documentary of the House Judiciary Committee and their debate that would eventually lead, in part, to President Nixon's resignation. Now, let's take a look at the sort of the general synopsis from this same documentary of everything that's happened up to where we left off in December of 1973. This lays the stage for you through the conventional wisdom of the heroic actions of the Watergate special prosecutors working with Judge Sirica to bring everyone to justice, and then taking the evidence that appears that President Nixon has done all this wrongdoing to the House Judiciary Committee for their debate right up to this point where they're going to form the committee.
There were stories then of the burglars' connection to the Nixon campaign, but they scarcely cast a shadow on the Nixon inauguration.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
January 1973, Richard Nixon at the pinnacle of power and glory. His re-election victory had swept 49 states. Now he was ready to announce an end to a decade of war in Vietnam. His inaugural address rang with triumph and optimism.
As we meet here today, we stand on the threshold of a new era of peace in the world.
Within weeks, it began to go sour. Five Watergate burglars were convicted in Judge John Sirica's court and linked to the Nixon re-election campaign. Then James McCord pointed his finger at the White House itself. He said he was offered money and executive clemency if he would keep quiet. There had been a cover-up at the White House. Now the conspirators began to crack. The White House counsel John Dean and the deputy campaign director Jeb Magruder went to the prosecutors to bargain. They would name names. In April, the widening scandal produced four resignations. Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, the president's closest aides, John Dean, and the Attorney General of the United States, Richard Kleindienst. The president assured the country there would be no whitewash. He appointed Elliot Richardson to be Attorney General and promised to respect an independent investigation.
He has the authority to name a special supervising prosecutor for matters arising out of the case.
With the blessing of the White House, Richardson appointed a special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Meanwhile, another investigation of Watergate began on television, drawing millions of citizens into the process of judgment.
The nation and history itself are watching us. We cannot fail our mission.
The U.S. Senate created the Select Committee on Watergate to investigate a variety of 1972 campaign irregularities. The trail kept leading back to the White House. Early on, Jeb Magruder testified that John Mitchell, the former Attorney General and Nixon campaign director, actually authorized the break-in.
Mr. Mitchell agreed to approve the project, and I then notified the parties of Mr. Mitchell's approval.
Mitchell denied advance knowledge of the break-in, but he did admit knowing about the cover-up and not telling the president about it. The closest aides, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, also insisted that the president had nothing to do with Watergate. But John Dean said the cover-up extended into the Oval Office.
Particularly with reference to the President of the United States, I'd like to say this. It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement.
The implication was obstruction of justice. It would become the first article of impeachment brought against the president. Dean also described the Nixon administration's willingness to use government agencies like the IRS to punish so-called political enemies. This kind of thing was the heart of the second article of impeachment, abuse of power.
but it would be another year before there'd be enough evidence to answer this famous question.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
The White House said Dean was simply lying, but John Dean's testimony suggested there could be a source of definitive proof. The president just might have been taping conversations in the Oval Office. A surprise witness, Alexander Butterfield, an obscure White House assistant, confirmed Dean's notion. There were tapes.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the president?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
So the struggle for the tapes had begun. The tapes that would bring down President Richard Nixon. He refused to release them to the Irvin Committee or to the special prosecutor. Archibald Cox went to court. Judge Sirica ordered the president to surrender the tapes. The president appealed. Again, the courts ruled against the president. By the fall of 1973, the president's support in the country was crumbling. Then in October, a new blow. Vice President Spiro Agnew suddenly resigned after pleading no contest to charges of tax evasion. Hoping to reassure Congress, the president chose the House Minority Leader, Gerald Ford, to succeed Agnew.
I'm a Ford, not a Lincoln.
If Congress was reassured, the benefits wore away quickly. The president was under court order to turn over the tapes. He offered Cox a deal: transcripts compiled by the White House rather than the actual recordings. At a press conference on Saturday, October 20th, Cox refused. Within hours, a furious president ordered him fired and the post of special prosecutor abolished. Attorney General Richardson and his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, promptly resigned rather than obey the order. This was the Saturday night massacre, a bitter night for those who wanted to believe the president had nothing to hide from an independent investigation, a scary night for those worried about the integrity of their institutions.
At stake in the final analysis is the very integrity of the governmental processes I came to the Department of Justice to help restore. The rest is for the American people to judge.
There was shock at the president's summary action. Washington was deluged by a 250,000 telegrams running overwhelmingly against the president. For the first time, editorials around the country were calling on him to resign. Some of them spelled out the alternative: impeachment. And the shocks continued. 5 days later, the White House suddenly announced a worldwide alert for American military forces. A crisis in the Middle East was given as the reason.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Grim White House reporters wondered if the president was desperately whipping up a national distraction. And they wondered aloud if the president was psychologically unstrung.
A lot of people have been wondering how you are bearing up emotionally under the stress of recent events.
The president said he could take the heat, but the news was that he was giving ground on Watergate. He would hand over the disputed tapes. He would appoint a new special prosecutor, but he would not resign.
I intend to continue to carry out to the best of my ability the responsibilities I was elected to carry out last November.
After the Saturday night massacre, the House knew it had to face up to the impeachment issue.
The House knew it had to face up to the impeachment issue. The wheels of justice are now turning because of this horrible night, the Saturday night massacre where Archibald Cox had been fired. There were a lot of other things going on at the time. Vice President Agnew had just stepped down from office in an unrelated situation. The Yom Kippur War between Israel and the Arab states had been raging, and the Soviets were deeply involved, and we come, as you'll hear later, almost on the verge of nuclear entanglement at one point. And in the middle of this, Richard Nixon moves to get rid of Archibald Cox, who faced him down in front of the world during the middle of a crisis, which is a pretty serious thing to have had happen. And you know, it's funny how the story of the Saturday night massacre gets told in this heroic form, But the truth is, yes, Elliot Richardson had said that he could not fire Cox, as did Williams Ruckelshaus. But the truth is, they all kind of knew it was going to happen, and that it would happen because of this press conference that Archibald Cox had had. The conventional wisdom is always paints the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office as the heroes trying to find justice. But what if the conventional wisdom isn't right? We have a man who we have shown over and over in the 1973 series that hopefully those of you who were listening to before we began this season, last season's shows. But here, we'll let him lay out. He has a new book, The Nixon Conspiracy. You can get it from jeffshepard.com. And I highly recommend this book. And it may change everything you ever thought about Richard Nixon and Watergate. And we're going to let him tell you when we come back. Hi, this is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And hello to the C-SPAN audience tonight. My name is Jim Byron. I'm President and CEO of the Richard Nixon Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you back to the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. I want to give a special welcome to Sandy Quinn, who's a member of the Board of Directors of the Nixon Foundation and a former president of the foundation. And I want to thank all of our President's Council members and Associates Club supporters here in the audience today, whose support of the Nixon Foundation makes all of these programs possible. So thank you to those of you who are President's Council members or Associates Club members. Next June, we will commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, a crime of consequence that would go on to define a scandal and a critical period in 20th century history. Our distinguished speaker this evening was inside of the White House as it all unfolded. Jeff Shepard was a White House fellow who was later assigned to the Domestic Council in the Nixon administration. When the White House began requiring a legal defense, as the Watergate matter grew in 1973 and 74, Jeff was the youngest lawyer on the team. He was the first to listen to the smoking gun tape. He coined the phrase smoking gun, in fact. Later, he was there in the East Room on August 9th, as President Nixon said farewell to his staff. And Jeff Shepard was standing in the back of the East Room, and he was not happy. After hearing the smoking gun tape, he believed, like many, that President Nixon was hiding the truth and had been for several years. And then Jeff started digging. And he dug, and he dug, and he dug for 15 years, through the documents and through files that were once sealed. And Jeff soon found out that what he was led to believe about Watergate, and indeed what the nation was led to believe, was, well, let's just say that there's more to the story. And I'll let him get into that this evening. Jeff is the author of The Nixon Conspiracy, Watergate, and the Plot to Remove the President. You can purchase your copy in the Nixon Library's gift shop, and Jeff will sign it this evening after tonight's program. This morning in the Washington Examiner, Paul Bedard wrote that Jeff Shepard's, quote, credibility is hard to challenge. Now, let's hear from the man himself. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Jeff Shepard.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it. Hello and welcome. Jim, thank you for those kind remarks. It's good to be back amongst friends. Friends from high school, I went to Long Beach Wilson, graduated in 1962. Friends from college, I went to Whittier College, like President Nixon, except I graduated in 1966. And friends from the Nixon White House, where I served for 5 years. I don't know that any of my friends from Harvard Law School are here, but if you note on the book, on the cover, my criminal law professor, Alan Dershowitz, said some very nice things about me. So, in addition to the above, as Jim mentioned, I was deputy counsel on President Nixon's Watergate defense team. And I was there throughout the scandal and its unfolding. I transcribed the White House tapes. I ran the document rooms holding the seized files of the Watergate defendants. And I staffed Nixon's counselors on Watergate issues. As you all know, it ended rather badly. President Nixon resigning in disgrace and 24 members of his administration going to jail. I've pondered ever since what exactly went wrong in our response to that burgeoning scandal, without really coming up with any answers. That is, until I learned some time ago that the Watergate prosecutor's files, at least those that survived, are maintained at our National Archives. The prosecutors were, after all, technically government employees. I've spent a lot of my time ever since reviewing those files, and that's a bit about what I'm going to talk to you tonight. But it's been 50 years. Since the scandal, and the backstory is rather complex, so we're going to approach this in two ways. I'm going to give you my own one-minute summary, and then I'm going to expand a little bit on that. Nixon was defeated, but it turns out the prosecutors cheated. They also left a paper trail, and that's what I've been spending the past few years uncovering. It's simply astonishing what they committed to writing. And their documents change everything we've been told about Watergate. They met secretly with Watergate trial judges. They suppressed evidence that was favorable to the defendants. They told outright lies to grand jurors and to congressional committees alike. And none of this was pursued by the press, by the so-called investigative reporters. There were clear leads at the time of what was going on, but those leads were never followed up because any such information wouldn't fit in with a narrative that was being told and it was being fed to the American public. It's taken 50 years, but the truth is finally coming out, and the memos I've uncovered are now all publicly available. You know, when they talk about the scientific method in sciences other than political science, they talk about the ability to duplicate the experiment. The whole point of the scientific method is, here's what I did. If you do the same thing, you should get the same result. What distinguishes my work, I think, from everyone else's on Watergate is I constantly cite memos. The memos exist. They are available now to the public at the National Archives. Now let's dig a little bit deeper into the scandal, because it gets pretty complex. But I suggest to you there are three things you can take to the bank. There are three undeniable truths about Watergate. There really was a break-in. There really was a cover-up. President Nixon really did resign. and everything else is up for grabs. Everything else you've been told is subject to question in light of what I've uncovered. So let's talk about the break-in. Five burglars were caught red-handed on June 17, 1972, in the Watergate offices of the Democrat National Committee. There was a thorough investigation. But it wasn't necessary for prosecutors to establish who had known of the break-in plans in order to convict the burglars. The career prosecutors decided to pursue the easy convictions first and then see if facing long jail terms loosened their tongues. This approach really frustrated the self-appointed trial judge, Chief Judge John Sirica. He wanted to use the trial in his private search for the truth, whatever that was, behind Watergate. Perhaps as frustrating, at the opening of trial, five of the defendants pleaded guilty. So the trial really didn't amount to much. And at the end of it, the judge expressed his disappointment, called for a Senate investigation, and gave prosecutors a list of eight Nixon people he demanded be brought in front of the grand jury. Well, the judge wasn't all wrong, because there really was a cover-up. You see, when the burglars were caught, the question was who else knew? Who knew in advance of this planned break-in? And it turned out some pretty senior people had advanced knowledge. But it's very clear that those people, with the possible exception of John Dean, all worked for the committee to re-elect the president, the re-election campaign committee. It's never been shown that any senior officials on the White House staff itself had advanced knowledge of the planned break-in. But the cover-up sucked some of them in. So the old saying about it's not the crime, it's the cover-up comes true, because if we had stopped the movie at the time of the break-in, people on the White House staff would not have been adversely affected, except for John Dean. So if you want to picture what happened, it's better to assume John Dean worked for the re-election committee, not for the White House he was supposed to represent. When the cover-up fell apart, as it should have, its instigators raced to make their own deals with the prosecution. The situation became hugely politicized. We see that today. When prosecutions become politicized, they go off the rails. A new force was brought in, created from scratch, the Watergate Special Prosecution Force, and consisted of 100 people from the beginning. It operated without guidance or supervision of the Department of Justice. And it promised to investigate every allegation of wrongdoing lodged against the Nixon administration since it first took office. In its own way, it was something of a legal pogrom. Specially recruited and highly partisan prosecutors operating without any budgetary or manpower restraints, targeting loads of specific Nixon people for investigation and prosecution. Well, that took its toll, and that brings us to our third undeniable truth. President Nixon really did resign. Haunted by his Oval Office tapes, hounded by the special prosecutors, he announced his resignation in an address to the nation on August 8, 1974. He was then pardoned by President Ford, but 24 members of his administration were convicted and sent to prison in the break-in, the cover-up, and the Plumbers trials. Now, this is interesting. President Nixon was never brought in before an actual trial. He wasn't tried in court, and there was no actual Senate trial. In either of those two instances, his guilt would have had to have been proven under the rules of evidence, by witnesses under oath, subject to cross-examination. But that was skipped. So the formal presentation of what Nixon was accused of having done never got into court, never got before the Senate. Now, he was convicted, all right, by the media. He was convicted by the Senate Ervin hearings, and he was convicted in the court of public opinion, but nothing formal. And that gap leaves plenty of room for doubt and for discussion. In between the break-in arrests and President Nixon's resignation and then the conviction of his senior aides were 2.5 years of Watergate stories as the scandal unfolded. And all America was mesmerized by the Senate hearings, by the prosecutions, and by the impeachment inquiry in the House. We're now in the midst of the 50th anniversary of that period. This past Labor Day marked the 50th year from the Fielding break-in. That was the break-in into the Beverly Hills offices of Daniel Ellsberg's shrink, looking to see what his plans might be for further leaks like the Pentagon Papers. It's not really connected to Watergate, but the break-in was planned and executed by Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, who were connected. So it planted the seeds that blossomed into the Watergate scandal. Right about this time, right about Thanksgiving, 50 years ago, John Dean was recruiting Gordon Liddy to design a campaign intelligence plan. It's unfortunate that he picked Gordon. It's unfortunate that Gordon got a little carried away with his plan. It involved proposals for mugging, bugging, kidnapping, and prostitution. So one of the fair things to say is that some of Nixon's people were hardly blameless in all this. The question was how high up the rot went, and that's where all the arguments exist even to today. As Watergate unfolded, a heavily partisan media helped to assure that the victors were lionized, that the vanquished were villainized. And afterwards, they told us the system had worked and that justice had prevailed. Well, not exactly. In fact, given what I've uncovered, you might conclude that the system didn't work and there was no justice for the Watergate defendants. Those things are covered. When Jim talked about my book, he didn't hold it up, so let me hold up my book, which is available to you today. It's my view of what happened back then, coupled with 50 years of disclosures based on my research. It's sort of a personal memoir of my involvement and a top-down review of how we would view Watergate today. There are three reveals in the book and in today's circumstances that make it very relevant to what's going on today. First is the unsealing of the Watergate roadmap. Second is the discovery of caches of documents that were improperly hidden from public view, prosecutors' documents. And third is the filing of a complaint of attorney misconduct. And I'll go through each of those for you because that's what makes it fun today, 50 years later. When the prosecutors decided that it was inappropriate to try to indict a sitting president, they settled on helping arrange his impeachment. And the way they decided to help was to take grand jury evidence that they had gathered for criminal prosecutions and convey it to the House of Representatives where it could be used to secure Nixon's impeachment. And they prepared a secret report. And it was called the roadmap because we were assured it would lead to Nixon's impeachment. It contained secret evidence that would certainly lead to his impeachment. But since it was sealed grand jury information, it was also sealed from public disclosure. And members of the White House defense team never knew what was in the roadmap. But the American public was assured, whatever it was, Nixon was guilty because it was irrefutable. The prosecutors said so. The roadmap remained secret for 45 years. And it was only recently made public in 2018 in response to my court petition. So for the first time in 45 years, we could learn what the accusations were against Richard Nixon. And you won't know of them because they disappeared. It turns out that the accusations included the charge that Richard Nixon had personally approved the payment of blackmail to one of the Watergate burglars. Now, in those days, it's different today, but in those days, there hadn't been an impeachment for 100 years. And it was generally believed that in order to void an election, to remove the president, you had to show he personally had committed a crime as grievous as treason or bribery, which are named in the Constitution. And the special prosecutor said, don't worry, we've got it. We can prove beyond the shadow of a doubt Nixon personally approved the payment of blackmail to Howard Hunt. We can tell you when he did it. But this charge was conveyed in secret. So I didn't learn about it until 2019 when I got around to reading the roadmap. The second important development recently is the discovery of confidential prosecutor files. In recent years, I've uncovered four caches of internal documents that the prosecutors took when they left office. Now, you aren't supposed to do that. These are government documents, but it's no wonder they took them. The prosecutors have incredible powers, particularly when coupled with the use of a grand jury. But they have to work within certain rules of conduct, reflecting the due process guarantees set forth in the Fifth and the Sixth Amendments. Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski's confidential Watergate files surfaced in 2013, 40 years after the fact. Those of Philip Lacovara, counsel to the special prosecutor, the one who did most of the staff work for the special prosecutor, surfaced in 2020. Both caches of documents are available today at the National Archives. Those of Archibald Cox, the first special prosecutor, and of his top assistant, James Vorenberg, are now available at Harvard's Law Library. They've declined to return them to the archives where they should be, but you can see them at Harvard. In each of these four instances, in each of these four caches of documents, I was the first to have access, treasure troves of new information. And what I've uncovered detail incredible wrongdoing by the prosecutors. They were so eager to nail Nixon, and there was no supervision from the Department of Justice, that they got carried away. And what is just astonishing to me, not that they got carried away, you could predict that, but they wrote memos bragging about it. And I've got the memos. The third development is the filing of a complaint of attorney misconduct. And this is, honestly, this is delicious. It's not in the book, but this is delicious. The Department of Justice established, after Watergate, a special internal affairs unit whose only job is to investigate and report on allegations of misconduct by Department of Justice attorneys. They have incredible power, but this is an internal affairs unit whose job is to make sure they didn't overstep their bounds. On October 3rd, which is 2 months ago, I filed a formal complaint of attorney misconduct about what the Watergate Special Prosecution Force attorneys did 50 years ago. And I filed it electronically the same day I discovered this group existed. And then the next day I sent them my books, which detail the documents and the wrongdoing. And then about a week later, I sent a registered letter. And I said, now don't think you're going to be getting out of this because this is 50 years ago, because the same attorneys who did wrong, who cut too many corners, are the ones who took their documents with them and prevented discovery of their wrongdoing. So this is ripe. Now, all I've heard back is official notice that they've received the complaint and they will launch an investigation. But this is really delicious. Ordinarily, when I'm at a cocktail party or something and people come up, you know, what about Watergate? And I start telling them, their eyes glaze over because the facts are complex and the stories are too convoluted and they decide to go get another drink. But this group, this is their job. I just hope and pray I'm granted an audience because I could go on for weeks about the wrongdoing done by these specially selected prosecutors. Now this, to kind of understand how this game ought to unfold, if you read detective stories, the hero is a tough cop who's trying to bring the bad guys to justice, and he cuts some corners in the name of pursuing justice. But every police department has an internal affairs unit, and these are the guys with straight spines who are sticklers for adherence right to the strict rules. And they're cast as the bad guys. Well, the Office of Professional Responsibility is that group within the Department of Justice. And if you go on my website, and I'll tell you about that in a minute, I've reproduced my complaint. So it'll be interesting to see where that leads. I'd relish wallowing in Watergate with a group of prosecutors whose job it is to decide whether their colleagues cut too many corners, given the dozens and dozens of memos that I've uncovered. Now, I don't really care if those members of the Watergate Special Prosecution Force who are still alive, if they get disciplined, they've basically retired. But what I want, Shepard's goal, is for the Justice Department to come into court. Like you may recall they did in the Senator Ted Stevens case, where they went in and they confessed error and they said, we can't stand behind this conviction because of the wrongdoing by our own attorneys. Imagine for a second the upheaval that would cause if the Department of Justice disowned the convictions in the cover-up trial, in the Plumbers trial, and the naming of President Nixon as an unindicted co-conspirator because of lies told to the federal grand jury. Well, all this except for that complaint, because it came after the book was at the publisher, all of this is extensively detailed and documented in my revised website, www.shepherdonwatergate.com. Now, those of you who happen to be lawyers may remember from law school, the prominent professors all had case books, and they were inevitably named after themselves as authors. So it was Prosser on torts and Chadbourne on evidence and Kasner and Leach on real property and Gellhorn and Bice on administrative law. Well, I consider myself to be an authority on the Watergate prosecutions, so I've named my website, my digital casebook is named shepherdonwatergate.com. Most authors develop their website to sell their books. I want you to buy my book. But my website approaches this differently. It has more detail about Watergate than you might ever want to know. It has links not just to the troubling memos in my books and my essays, but some peripheral things to my complaint of attorney misconduct. You can see it, it's right there. You can read it. To the off-Broadway stage play that we produced this past August. It's called Trial on the Potomac. And it's kind of fun. It portrays the impeachment trial that President Nixon might have received if he hadn't resigned. The only stickler is everything I've uncovered since comes out at that trial. And the audience is left to ponder, if everything we know today was known back in 1974, could the Democrats have mustered the 67 votes necessary to remove him? We don't know, but that's what the play asks. I also did 9 hours of video interviews with Hugh Hewitt here at the library in 2020. That's posted. And I did 18 hours of lectures at Temple University in Philadelphia in 2019. Now, the Hugh Hewitt lectures are all oral and more fun. The Temple lectures are accompanied by about 200 slides, PowerPoint slides, citing documents or portions of books that build a case for all of the wrongdoing. What my wife of 48 years terms my Nixon obsession has been all-consuming. Imagine what she goes through. But by making my research available online, I hope to make the true story of Watergate prosecutors, really the persecution of Nixon and his top staff, publicly available to students, to scholars, to researchers, and over time, to bend the arc of history. It's pretty much agreed today that the first impeachment of Andrew Johnson back after the Civil War was politicized and baseless. It's growing that there's agreement that the 1960 election was stolen from Richard Nixon. It's not such an outlandish thought at all. I hope I live long enough to see a situation where it becomes generally agreed, or at least understood by a number of people, that the Watergate prosecutions were not done fairly, were not done with regard to the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, that in a time of national political turmoil, the guarantees of our Constitution didn't withstand the onslaught of partisan prosecutors. You see, Nixon really was driven from office by a secret cabal of specially recruited prosecutors, vindictive judges, and highly partisan congressional staff. The documents I have uncovered prove it.
Now, there's one more part of the puzzle that Jeff Shepard didn't mention, and that's the Washington-based national news media, Washington and New York City. Nixon was never a part of that Northeast media elite, and they never liked him. And it's a very interesting comparison that I saw about comparing Richard Nixon to Donald Trump from the friends at Vox. And I thought this was pretty fascinating. It happened during the Trump impeachment or the Trump investigation with Robert Mueller. But it tells you the difference between the national news media of then, 50 years ago, and today. And it's very interesting to see how they phrase and characterize things, because the way they phrase it, it's as though the media is gotten out of control, and now you know the bad right wing conspiracy mongering media world protects these presidents from wrongdoing because they were wonderful back 50 years ago. My own interpretation is it, and let me just say I'm editorializing here, is that really what they're complaining about is they've lost control and they can't railroad anybody anymore.
Nixon and Trump. Both presidents faced major FBI investigations, were accused of obstructing justice, called their investigations witch hunts, and oozed raw sexual charisma. It's not a perfect analogy, but the similarities have led some to argue that, like Nixon, Trump's time is running out.
What's going on here is very Nixonian.
Having prosecuted the Watergate case, we're well on our way to impeachment.
I was in the Nixon administration, as you know. I think we're in impeachment territory now.
Really?
But the truth is, these two are living in totally different worlds. And that has less to do with what's happening at the FBI and more to do with what's happening on Fox News.
The media and the Democrats have lied to you,
trying to create a Watergate out of this.
Desperate to get back to the days of Watergate.
The elite media is part of the deep state.
You, the American people, should never trust this destroy Trump corrupt media.
I know we're all trapped in a flaming media hellscape right now, but during Watergate, things were way different. At the time, there were three national nightly broadcast news shows, 30 minutes each. Big cities typically had one or two major papers. There were a couple of radio stations, and that was about it. No 24-hour cable news, no push notifications, no Twitter, no blogs, no internet. God, that sounds peaceful. And that meant that Democrat or Republican, Americans were basically getting the same news.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
People are basically reading and hearing and watching the same things, and they, by and large, believe the news that they hear.
This is Nicole Hemmer, political historian and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. We'll get to that transformation in a second. Hemmer says there is conservative media in 1970. It just looks really different.
There is conservative talk radio. There are conservative publications like National Review and Human Events, but they're so much smaller than they are today. Like, when I talk about Human Events and National Review, that's just about it when it comes to weekly conservative publications.
And while that might seem like a supply problem, it's actually a demand problem. In the 1970s, Americans had incredible trust in the news they were getting. 69%.
Nice.
Are you serious? 69% of Americans expressed a great or fair amount of trust in the media. And that trust meant there wasn't really an appetite for right-wing news.
Most Americans have faith in the objectivity of mainstream media. They trust it. If Walter Cronkite says something, it's not seen as liberal propaganda. It's seen as, here's this guy who knows something, who's telling us something objective and true about the world.
And that's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is.
That became a big deal during Watergate. As the investigation turned into a national story, Nixon lashed out, calling it a witch hunt and attacking the media for covering it.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous reporting in 27 years of public life.
And conservative outlets came to Nixon's defense. One conservative radio personality said the press had turned a prosecution into a persecution. Another argued that a gullible public was caught in the talons of the press. Who talks like that? An article in National Review even suggested that Watergate was a trap set up by the CIA.
They definitely didn't use the language of the deep state, but that was kind of lurking there.
But despite their efforts, conservative media just couldn't change people's minds about what was going on.
They don't have the power to drive or to shape the conversation about Watergate. There's not really an alternative story Republicans can credibly spin, because they're not just going up against Democrats, they're going up against all of the networks, all of the newspapers. And so having that uniting narrative, that really matters.
To be under a constant barrage on each of the three major networks tends to raise some questions in the people's minds.
That's really too much for Republicans to resist.
My phone calls were 100-1 in favor of pursuing the path of impeachment, which was rather shocking to me.
By 1974, Republicans in Congress begin moving to impeach Nixon. And by August, Nixon resigns.
Events have been rushing toward one seemingly inevitable conclusion, removal from office.
There was kind of a cohesive message about what Watergate was, what it meant. It would have been nearly impossible for the Nixon administration to muddy the waters. That's not the case today.
Right, today. The flaming hellscape, or as Hemmer might call it, the transformation. In the past 50 years, trust in traditional media has plummeted with all Americans, but especially with Republicans. And the demand for conservative media has exploded. What started off as a few rinky-dink conservative magazines has become an entire ecosystem of right-wing TV, talk radio, and websites.
You can now exist within a comprehensive, closed conservative media ecosystem, whether it's having Fox News on all the day or talk radio on all day. You don't need to really ever step out of that bubble, which is something you couldn't have done before.
Republicans aren't getting their news from Cronkite anymore. They're getting it from Fox. And that's a huge deal when it comes to the Mueller investigation. Republicans during Watergate were turning on their TV and seeing this.
The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history.
Now, they're seeing this.
Biggest non-story ever being hyped by the liberal media.
Greatest political hoax.
Right. Farce and a witch hunt.
It's a sham. It is a house of cards.
The American people will put up with a great deal, but they will not put up with anyone who claims to be above the law.
The president says it's fake news. Do you even care? How can anyone trust the Mueller office?
A bunch of Trump-hating, Hillary-loving, partisan hacks.
A grave and profound crisis in which the president has set himself against his own attorney general and the Department
Department of Justice.
It's one giant, huge web of corruption.
The FBI has become America's secret police.
The FBI needs a complete cleansing.
Mueller is frankly a disgrace to the American justice system.
These people need to be taken out and cuffed.
That uniting narrative we had during Watergate, it's gone. And without it, Republicans in Congress have a strong incentive to turn their backs on the Mueller investigation.
They know that the Republican base is tuned into conservative media and hearing these messages that the Mueller investigation is a sham, that this is a project of the deep state to bring down the president.
Mueller is out to get the president, it appears, at any cost.
And so if a Republican politician breaks with that, then all of a sudden it looks like he's siding with the enemy.
And siding with the enemy could be a political death sentence. A 2017 study found that watching Fox News had a significant effect on elections, shifting 6% of voters towards the Republican presidential candidate in 2008.
In that environment, politicians have to choose sides. And if you're a Republican, do you choose to side with the media that all your base listen to? Or do you choose to side with the one they all oppose?
House Republicans have already released a report attempting to undermine the Mueller investigation.
There's no reason to continue this. We've turned up nothing.
And some have begun echoing Fox News' talking points.
Mueller is desperate. He doesn't have a case. He can make.
This Mueller investigation is built on a false premise and rotten to the core, Tucker.
Is the integrity of the agency in question then now?
Of course it is.
We know there's bias. We know there's conflict.
And I agree with you, Sean. They're trying to manufacture a process crime.
This is increasingly becoming scary stuff.
You agree?
It is. Yes, I do agree with that.
Of course, we don't know if Trump will fire Mueller or if Mueller will actually dig up any dirt on Trump. But if either of those things do happen, it'll be up to Republicans in Congress to do something about it. And right now, Hemmer isn't confident they will.
It's very hard to imagine a future in which all of a sudden they're going to say, oh wait, we now need to listen to this independent counsel who most of the conservative media have been undermining and delegitimizing for months now.
And before you call me dramatic, listen to how actual Fox News hosts are talking about this stuff.
Nixon never would have been forced to resign if you existed back in 1972, 73, 74.
I was literally 11 years old.
It's too bad for Nixon because nobody like you existed then. Our prime responsibility now is to unshackle the 45th president of the United States.
These investigations might be really similar, but on TV, they could not look more different. And for Republicans in Congress, that might be all that matters.
And that's the way it is.
As I said before I introduced that clip, what they're upset about is not that the right-wing media is spreading rumors and lies, is that they've lost control. And one of the things that I did enjoy about President Trump was that you could see media figures like Elizabeth Drew, Dan Rather, Bob Woodward, and Carl Bernstein, you could see their frustration as they attacked President Trump on Twitter and nobody listened to them. Now, do you think that the press was unbiased 50 years ago and that they were not out to get Richard Nixon? Let me give you Exhibit A. Richard Nixon won the 1972 presidential election, 49 states to one, and the District of Columbia, the largest landslide in American history. Here is the great Dan Rather as the state of Indiana comes in.
Walter, as you know, Indiana is considered the most southern of the Midwestern states, one time bastion of the Ku Klux Klan and a traditionally Republican state. No surprise that CBS News estimates that President Nixon has carried Indiana.
Yep, Indiana, that racist state full of Klansmen, voted for the Grand Wizard, Richard Nixon. And 36 years later, they voted for Barack Obama. Subtle, but it is what it is.